And good morning to everyone. Our first case today is State v. Joseph A. Gill. Mr. Steele, good morning to you. You may approach, and you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Steele. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for you. I represent Joseph Gill, who was charged in the District Court of Saunders County, Nebraska. This matter comes before the court on an interlocutory appeal of the District Court's denial of the defendant's motion for absolute discharge. The defendant filed a motion alleging that the state did not bring the defendant to trial within the statutory time period under Section 29-1207. Also, along with that particular motion, the defendant did file a motion for dismissal of the charges as being time-barred under Nebraska Statute 29-110. I will inform the court that the trial court's decision did not rule on that particular motion, so I bring that before the court as an error by the district court in not making a ruling. I don't have a lot of factual detail as this matter has not gone to trial. This is a procedural matter basically involving the timeline of the pretrial and the trial dates that were scheduled before the court. The statute is clear that if the defendant is not brought to trial before the running of the time for the trial is provided in Section 29-1207, unless extended by any excluded periods, he or she is entitled to an absolute discharge from the offense charged and any offense required by law to be joined with that offense, as set forth in 29-1208. The facts in this timeline are really not in dispute. The state filed the information against the defendant on November 9th, 2015. The defendant did file a pretrial motion, which was filed on November 6th, and was under advisement until February 4th, 2016. Now, under the statutory scheme, that is an excluded period for the calculation of the running of the speedy trial under that section, because it was a motion that was filed by the defendant relating to some allegation of the evidence.
Counsel, at the hearing on the motion for absolute discharge, was there any argument with respect to the constitutional speedy trial claims, or was it focused exclusively on the statutory speedy rights?
I will say to the court that we addressed the statutory issues. The motion that was filed was alleged constitutional grounds.
But you didn't argue
there was not much argument on the constitutional ground.
Any?
I cannot recall any specific arguments relating to that, other than the fact that when we got to the absolute discharge, it was alleged through the state's action that there was a delay that in bringing the defendant to trial, which violates his constitutional rights to a fair and speedy trial. The delays were by the state after the state filed a motion to continue on August 1st. And
is it your position that you then brought both a motion for speedy trial, statutory speedy trial discharge, and constitutional speedy trial?
The motion had allegations of both.
Okay, but you didn't get any direct decision on the constitutionality of the...
I don't believe so.
The constitutional speedy
trial. Right, the court focused on the statutory language and did calculations of the case.
But the court overruled the motion, didn't it?
On which motion is that, Your Honor?
The motion for absolute discharge.
That's correct. It did not rule on the
motion
to discharge.
At the very least, there was an implicit denial of any constitutional ground, wasn't there? That's not hanging out there, is it?
Well, I would say that I would brief that issue, Your Honor, and that the court just denied the absolute discharge.
And you'd raised statute and constitution in the motion, so isn't that the end of that story? I mean, either it had merit or it didn't, but it's been ruled on.
And that's what I'd say, Your Honor, right. Here that the court erred on making that determination.
Do you think it's plausible that the court didn't address the constitutional claim because no one presented an argument with respect to it?
That is plausible. I think most of the argument focused on the statutory.
Which ones? Which one's your stronger argument?
The statutory scheme. If I could outline the point of this, the matter proceeded to trial, and it was set for the initial trial on after the arraignment on July 13th. And pursuant to the local procedure, the courts hold a status hearing, and the status hearing was held on June 20th, and the defendant did make a motion to continue. But that was a motion that was not an indefinite continuance. It was a continuance of the trial date to allow further discovery, and the court continued the trial on that motion and continued the trial.
You said it wasn't indefinite. Did you ask for a specific date to be continued?
Your Honor, the court sets these on a jury docket panel in Saunders County on a monthly basis. And at that particular point, I asked for the next available jury term, which was in September. And the court set the next trial on September 15th. And it was one of the primary points of this argument is that is not an indefinite continuance. That indefinitely waives the defendant's right to speedy trial. That is a continuance from the July jury trial date to the September trial. And that time would have run against the defendant because of his request.
Was that still within the 6 months from the time the information was filed?
That would have still been within the 6 month period of time.
How about the October 12th date?
Well, here's the argument of the appellant on this is that in July, and the court ruled on August 1st, granted the state's motion to continue the trial. The state filed a motion to continue the trial, which was granted on August 1st, which continued the trial from that date and put it into October. And that was on the state's motion. And the trial judge recognized that that would restart the clock, and in fact, in his ruling, stated that the time would not run against the defendant and the clock would beginning to run again. It was the state's motion.
From August or September?
From August 1st. And I think the law is pretty clear that when a continuance is granted, until the continuance is done, is the time period that would be relevant. Just as if when the defendant filed his motion for a trial to a continuance, it ran from the date the court granted his motion to continue, not the future trial date that was scheduled. It would be the same argument that the appellate making here, that on August 1st, the trial was continued. And then that was a result of the state's action. And that took it outside the statutory period.
Is this correct that the state contends that the new end of the 6 months was October 20? Is that right?
Well, I would just agree with that. I think in my brief I had that set forth that it would run from August 1st until the rescheduled trial date in October panel.
But the state's position is 6 months was over October 20. And there was at that on October 20, there existed a trial date of October 12.
I think their contention was that the clock would not begin to run again against the state on August 1st. They claimed it would not begin to run until the September trial date would not have occurred. And my argument in response to that is the continuance granted on August 1st. That's the order of continuance. The defendant could not have showed up on September 15th for a trial. It was removed from the jury docket. And just like when the defendant makes a motion at any prior hearing before trial, it stops the running of the clock. And so this was all upon the state's motion for an extension of time. And we would submit that that is grounds for absolutely.
Suppose, I realize you're using time, but suppose that you had never filed a motion for continuance. The state had filed a motion, and you showed up at the hearing and said, well, we agree to the continuance to September, but not to October. Do you think that the time would run against the state under those circumstances from August to September?
Well, I guess when you say you agree, if the statute says that the defendant consents, that may be some issue, but it was not the motion in this case. The state filed the motion.
But you'd already filed a motion, hadn't you?
Mine was for a previous, for an extension from a July date. They went after the July date in August.
Well, I'm having trouble with the period from August to the September date that your motion had already accomplished, why that isn't excludable.
Well, Your Honor, as I would say, it's just the time that is included and excluded. When the state filed that motion, it took away the defendant's opportunity to come to trial on that schedule.
So if the state had waited until the September date and filed its motion and obtained the continuance then, you would agree that, okay, the clock didn't run until September, but by waiting till the last minute, they can avoid having the clock run against
them. That would be my contention, that the filing on August 1st was what restarted the clock on that state motion. Yes, they could have done that a day before trial, and that
Which
would not have been timed.
Doesn't seem like very conducive to very good trial practice.
That, you know, Your Honor, I can only put out the rules that are followed and the process, and that would be my contention.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
What was the original speedy trial date that he was charged in November, is that right? Of what was it? 2015?
Yes.
And then the 6 months period would start to run from the date he's charged?
It would, except for periods that are excluded based upon defendant's motion.
Okay.
Which included the motion to quash.
That's correct.
You agree to that?
Yes, I do agree that that time period in which the defendant had filed a motion and while it was under advisement.
Well, maybe that pushed us out to about February maybe or something?
That's correct. It was on February 4th.
Maybe the better question is, at the time you filed your motion for continuance on July or June 20th, what was the six-month period at that time?
The six-month period would have been everything, would have been running except for those days which are, and I recall.
Wasn't the six-month period around July 27th?
Your Honor, I can't say with certainty. Sometime around August, end of July, 1st of August.
Okay, it was before the September trial date.
Yes, but there was a continuance granted on the defendant's motion until that said.
Right. But unless you, by filing that motion for continuance, didn't you take the trial date outside the six-month period on June 20th?
Yes, that would be correct, I believe.
So how do you get around the statutory requirement that if you file a motion that takes your trial set within the six-month period outside the six-month period, you waived your statutory speedy trial requirements?
Well, Your Honor, as I said, I believe that is not an indefinite continuance, but that was just a continuance that moves that and stops the clock from the speedy trial running. So that's the statutory.
Okay. Is that consistent with Mortensen?
You're right. It is. In regard to Mortensen, I think that was an entirely and factual issue and procedurally not inaccurate, but not accurate in the sense that under that case, there had been filings of motions to continue by the defendant all the way through in these cases and attempts to try to calculate that during that motion for continued, there should have been time running. And I don't believe that the Mortensen, when you look at those facts, is applicable, to this particular matter. It was the same concept. They had motion to continue trial with status hearings and continued the trial the entire time, and then few days before the trial, filed a motion to discharge, claiming that violation. And they used resetting of trial dates as times where it should be running. And as I say, my petition, it runs from the trial date that was set, and not any sort of pretrial or status hearing in the interim.
I know we've
I don't
taken you.
Mortensen is factually heading.
Thank you.
We've taken you a long over time, but your argument strikes me that you're taking the legislative language in 29-1207-4B, which was changed. Mortensen addressed new language. And it seems to me you're inserting the word indefinite before continuance in that new language from the legislature. What's your best argument that it doesn't matter whether or that I'm wrong? In other words, I'm suggesting to you, for purposes of argument, that it doesn't matter whether it's indefinite or to a definite date. Under that language, when you ask for a continuance that takes you beyond the then existing 6-month period, speedy trial, statutory speedy trial is gone. What's your best argument to the contrary?
Well, Your Honor, I think in that particular case, when you do that, you're only, according to the statute, waiving that for a specific period of time. I just say that it's not a final waiver of your speedy trial rights just because you have a period of exclusion for a couple months on a motion.
So you would disagree with our statutory interpretation in Mortensen?
Well, I believe that that's not the... They focused on the issue of whether or not continuance with the clock was running or not running in the calculation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you very much. Ms. Duffy, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Counsel, I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appellee of the State of Nebraska. Appellant has assigned three errors on appeal. Denial of his motion for absolute discharge based upon his statutory right to a speedy trial, denial of his motion for absolute discharge based upon his constitutional right to a speedy trial, and the failure of the district court to consider his motion to dismiss based upon statute of limitations issues. Pending any questions from this court, I will briefly address appellant's second and third assignments of error before moving into discussing his statutory speedy trial claims. Regarding the motion to dismiss, the state believes that appellant's argument related to this motion to dismiss is not properly before this court. Appellant acknowledges that the district court did not rule upon that motion in the order denying the motion for absolute discharge. And that order denying the motion for absolute discharge is the order that is currently on appeal to this court. Because the district court did not rule upon the motion to dismiss in that motion for absolute discharge, there's no ruling on it currently on appeal to this court, and so this court does not have jurisdiction over the motion to dismiss issues at this time.
Is it the state's position that that motion, not the absolute discharge, but the motion to dismiss, is in effect still pending in the district court?
Well, I suppose so, Your Honor, because there was no ruling on it.
And there's been no trial. There's been nothing that would have automatically and without any doubt disposed of that motion implicitly, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Didn't the court overrule a similar motion that had been previously filed? And if so, what's the difference between this motion, the one we're discussing now, and the one that was previously denied?
Well, Your Honor, the appellant's motion to quash raised the statute of limitations issues, and that was denied in February. And appellant filed a motion to dismiss that was titled a motion to dismiss, but was really asking for a motion. At the end of it was asking for a motion to quash and a motion to dismiss. So I think that may be the reason that the district court did not rule upon the motion to dismiss, because it had already been disposed of in that earlier order in February.
And that's on the statute of limitations?
Correct. That was the statute of limitations.
Now, this is an amended information, is that right?
The amended information added the habitual criminal.
So a motion to quash, motion to dismiss, would have been to the amended information, not the original information. Is that accurate?
Your Honor, I hadn't really considered that issue, and I would have to go back and read the motion to see maybe what it referenced. I guess at the end of the day, the state's position is that it was not ruled upon in the order that is before this court. So that the only issue before this court is what is contained in the final order that is on appeal, which is the ruling on the motion for absolute discharge.
Okay, were there, on the motion for discharge, were both the speedy trial, statutory speedy trial, and the constitutional speedy trial raised at that time?
Your Honor, the motion in the kind of opening paragraph of the motion, it states it is being brought pursuant to appellant's constitutional and speedy trial rights.
Okay, and then the court overruled that motion, right?
Correct. The state does not really believe that. In the motion itself, while the word constitutional is mentioned the one time, all arguments focused on those statutory speedy trial, the six-month calculations, and the argument before the district court on the motion focused on the statutory six-month calculations, and the district court's order on the motion denying it focused solely on the statutory issues.
The state doesn't believe that there's still a pending motion for discharge on constitutional grounds, does it?
Your Honor, I haven't really considered the issue from that point of view. I think ultimately the district court did not make any specific findings on the constitutional issue.
Well, it doesn't have to make specific findings, does it?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. I know for the statutory speedy trial.
If it overrules the motion, it probably overrules both aspects that were raised in the trial court. What's the last day for trial of the defendant? I know the trial date was set July 13th. That was within the six-month period. What would be the last day that would be within the six-month period?
As of June 20th, the date of the appellant's motion
right.
to mm-hmm. continue. The state believes it would have been July 27th. I may have been
an off. That checks with my figures.
Okay.
So then this motion moved the trial date that was within the six-month period to outside the six-month period.
That's correct.
The defendant argues, but it was an indefinite continuance, and therefore that section of the law requiring a trial within 6 months or a waiver if you continue it outside that 6 months. What's your argument on whether indefinite or definite makes any difference?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it does. The plain language of the statute says a continuance granted at the request of the defendant or his counsel, which takes a trial which had been timely I have it here. It's a defendant is deemed to have waived his or her right to a speedy trial when the period of delay resulting from a continuance granted at the request of defendant or his or her counsel extends the trial date beyond the statutory six-month period. And the state's position is that here on June 20th, the date appellant filed asked to continue, there had been a trial scheduled within that six-month period, and that appellant's motion to continue trial pushed that trial to outside that six-month period, and that based on the plain language of the statute and this court's interpretation of the statute in Mortensen, he has permanently waived his statutory right to a speedy trial.
And that's the end of your analysis. Sorry.
Correct.
Essentially,
Honor.
That's
yes,
it.
Yes, Your Honor.
My question is how does the trial court's advisement with respect to speedy trial at the time a motion to continue is made, how, if at all, does it factor into the permanent waiver and the rule in Mortensen?
Your Honor, I realize here that the phrasing used, it may have been phrased inartfully, and I don't know that it was the district court's intention to, the phrasing, I don't know, it may have been a little confusing. I think ultimately the district court cannot overcome the statute, that the statute says what it says, and that if the continuance takes a timely trial outside the trial, it's permanently waived. And at the end of the day, the statute is what controls.
Well, the district court made that ruling, didn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The district court made that ruling, that there was a permanent waiver of the statutory speedy trial.
The district court went through the analysis and actually calculated out the time that was left on the speedy trial clock and found that there was still time remaining to bring the appellant to trial at the time he had filed his motion for absolute discharge.
And that was based on the date of the state's request of continuance versus the trial date. Is that the August to September?
I believe, yeah. The district court in its ruling on it, it counted the time period from September 14th, what would have been the trial, to October 11th, the new trial date against the state. It found that the clock was running from September 14th to October 11th.
So the time from July until September 14th was calculated against the defendant?
Correct, Your Honor. As mentioned, the state does not believe that we...
You say the trial court didn't make a decision based on that statute. I find that... I disagree with that.
I apologize, Your Honor. I could... I mean, I'm not sure where you're looking in the ruling. It may be that I missed it, so I apologize if I...
Well, I hope I didn't miss it.
Before you sit down, I want to say you are absolutely correct to the extent you argue that a district court has the duty to articulate findings regarding statutory speedy trial motions in terms of the excludable and includable periods. And my question earlier did not mean to contradict that, but I don't think there's any similar requirement to articulate findings regarding a constitutional motion for speedy trial, and I hope that we are on the same page in that regard.
Yes, and I have not done a lot of research into that issue, so I will get to go do that now, so
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Justice Wright, I'm not, I guess as I read the district court's motion, because she had calculated out the time that was remaining.
I thought maybe they did both, but I thought the primary...
And it may have. It's a long order. I'd have to...
Primary, I thought the reason was that the speedy trial had run, or that the defendant had waived the statutory speedy trial claim.
By moving
the trial outside the 6 month trial date to a trial beyond the 6 month period.
And I suppose, I think I read it more as for this period it was waived, and then for this next period it was waived, but we may just be reading it differently.
Well, maybe the district court's really reading it differently, too.
If there are no additional questions, we request you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. So we will go on to the next.